Welcome to the first full day of the Aspen Institute Ideas Festival. My name is Michelle McMurray, and I direct the health program at the Institute. Just wanted to welcome you to this really exciting seminar. Dr. Heber was kind enough to participate in a panel last year at the Ideas Festival, and his comments were so popular, and everyone found them so engaging that we thought it would be great if he'd give a complete talk today and really fill us in. So he's going to tell you a little bit about his background, but the talk in general has to do with how our individual genes and biological background interact with nutrition.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here again at the Aspen Ideas Festival, and I want to thank everyone involved in organizing it, and Stuart and Linda Resnick and the Gersons and everybody who's involved here, because this is a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for education and growth for everyone, and so I really feel privileged to be here. My background, basically, I grew up in Los Angeles, went back east for school, and came back to Los Angeles, always wanted to teach at UCLA. And, you know, careful what you wish for, but I've been there for 20 years teaching nutrition and started the nutrition program at UCLA. And I've written four books for the public. One of them was about Chinese red yeast rice called Natural Remedies for a Healthy Heart. Another one was called The Resolution Diet, when I thought that people could actually resolve to eat right. That was in my younger years. And then I was more optimistic. And then my last two books are What Color Is Your Diet, which we'll talk about a little bit today. It's been very popular, actually, with the food industry, and a lot of people, kind of a non-threatening book. And my latest book, The L.A. Shape Diet, which was more for a weight loss audience, because I run a lot of the obesity programs at UCLA. So today's topic is personalized nutrition and your genes, a glimpse into the future and what you can eat while you wait. All of us are about 99.9% genetically identical. And that 0.1% difference, some of the things relate to skin pigmentation relative to the sun and various things that the external environment does to us. And the other parts of our individuality have to do with our internal environment, our milieu interieur, as it's called. And that's what we're going to talk about today, the things of the internal environment. Nutrition has interested everybody. This has been a bane of my existence at cocktail parties forever. On both of my books, I had to fire the lay writers because they started arguing with me about nutrition halfway through the books, because everyone who eats is an expert in nutrition. And that goes way back to the naturalistic era of Hippocrates, who said, let medicine be your food and food be your medicine. Maimonides, who I read his original stuff, goes back to the 11th century. And a lot of it was common sense. It's amazing how much you can do with just observational stuff about how to treat common ailments. And then the chemical era came in, and a lot of the things we're going to talk about today about energy balance and calories, it's not only not rocket science, but it goes back to 1750. My daughter makes fun of me because I love to download Mozart into my iPod and greatest hits of 1750, but a lot of that goes back to that era. And then the biological era, 1900 to the present, back in the 20s, people would get a Nobel Prize for identifying a vitamin. And they actually thought that vitamins were proteins. The word vitamin, actually, amine comes from amino acid. It means protein, and vita means life. So here you would take something out of the diet of an animal. The animal would get sick and die. And now you just put back that little chemical, and the animal would pop up, and it was healthy again. Boy, that's a Nobel Prize-winning thing. And the first vitamin was vitamin A, because that's the first one, and vitamin B, and so forth. It went on. And that era was a great era for nutrition. And then nutrition kind of went into the background after World War II with the discovery of molecular biology. Everyone felt that now we have genes, we're going to find DNA, we're going to find a drug. And one of my least favorite comments is the druggable target. The idea that you have this target. And we have a wonderful Israeli researcher at UCLA who talks about guided missiles going into the prostate, you know, that type of thing, you know, targeting a particular site. And that's not how nature works. We have lots of networks, and I heard, you know, Deepak Chopra loves to talk about these symphonies that we have going on in our bodies and all this. And it's true. We're not built like a 1956 Chevy. We don't have one spark plug and one distributor. We have lots of backup kinds of things. And the molecular and cellular nutrition era is 2000 to the present 21st century. And that's what we're going to talk about today, genetics, genomics, proteomics, and metabolomics. Lots of long words with omics in them. But to really talk about the future of nutrition, it is these four areas. Number one, we're going to talk about energy balance and obesity. Very simple, yet people try to make it complicated. Nutrigenetics, this is a real cutting-edge area, the differences between different people. We know that different people react differently to the same foods. The most common example would be milk intolerance, lactose intolerance. Most people on Earth today cannot drink milk of any type. It's only those societies around the world, and I have a little map of them, that drank milk from goats or cows or anything they were herding that developed the ability to digest milk. Because if those children couldn't digest milk, they died before they came to the age of reproduction. And therefore, their genes were not passed on. So those children who died in childhood, they never had any descendants. And so the ones who couldn't digest milk simply died. So there are many people from Northern Europe and so forth who digest milk, but people from Asia, from Mexico, from Latin America, from throughout the world do not digest milk. They eat vegetable diets, and I think the Japanese diet's one of the healthiest in the world, with soy protein, lots of fruits and vegetables, and ocean-caught fish. So we'll talk about that. Nutrigenomics is actually the effect of substances in our food supply on our genes. You think drugs are great. There are 25,000 natural plant nutrients found in plants that have beneficial effects on health. And we'll talk about that a little bit, all the way up to the pomegranate, which we've been working on most recently. And that's the area of phytochemicals beyond antioxidation. Everybody knows what an antioxidant is. The word phytochemical kind of scares people because it's a chemical, it must be bad for you. So I try to use the word natural plant nutrient because it's something that's naturally there. So some people feel that they're fatalists, and they say, well, your genes are everything, and certainly genes play a role. We all know the Jim Fix story. Well, you know, he died of a heart attack running. Well, I may as well go have a steak and French fries, you know. And that's the thought process. You know, the heck with these guys. They don't know what they're talking about and so forth. But it is true that if you have genes that really are pushing you toward very bad genes, there's very little we can do about it. But that's thankfully not the common situation. Most of us have genes that are there for another purpose. They were put there 50,000 years ago when mankind was in Africa. And as we migrated north, there were certain changes selected for in the genome, similar to the milk story I told you. But the story that they selected for had to do with green leafy vegetables, because you couldn't grow green leafy vegetables in the colder climates of Northern Europe. So they started growing grains. So then nature had to make a choice. What are we going to do with your genes? Are we going to protect the genes for reproduction just until you reproduce? Or are we going to worry about what's going to happen until you're 80 years of age? And nature said, well, no, I'm only going to worry about what happens until you reproduce. Everything else, that's your business. So what nature has done, there are two sets of genes that are very important to us. Number one are the genes to protect us from starvation. Because if you've been out in the forest for 3 days and you're looking for a small rabbit or chicken, you've got to be able to look for that person and still be energetic and be able to hunt. And the second thing is protection from infection. Because living in the wild, all wild animals are chronically infected. They're all infected with parasites. Their immune system is constantly turned on. With nutrition and sanitation, we moved to Europe, and you all know about the Black Death killing 90% of a population. Many of the rare diseases like cystic fibrosis were developed by nature to protect against an infectious disease. And the way that nature did that is if you have two copies of a gene, if you have one normal copy and one that would be a cystic fibrosis or sickle cell disease gene, that protects you. Sickle cell disease will protect you from malaria. So if you have a good gene and a bad gene, that's great. But then that part of the population that got both bad genes, they die early of sickle cell disease. So there's a gene there for a good purpose, but it can be turned against you. Those are very rare examples. Sickle cell is not that common. Cystic fibrosis, thankfully, not that common. So what about the common genes? What are those common genes that we have? Number one, to protect from starvation. Number two, to protect from infection. So your body is geared up to a rapid inflammatory response every time that you get infected. Because if you're living in bad sanitary conditions, you've got to fight that infection immediately before it eats your arm or something else. So you've got to be able to defend yourself. Now, this, unfortunately, is our way of life in middle America on Route 66. This is what you see. Most of these guys here have a little too much in the way of energy. So what they've done is taken this gene for hanging on to energy, and they've kind of overdone it, you know, to the point that Levi Strauss is having a hard time keeping up. So if you look in the human genome, we have these 22 genes, and this happens to be a male gene, so we have an X and a Y, so that's a male. There are 24 chromosomes. Women, by the way, have two X chromosomes, and it's very interesting. Women, of course, outlive men for many reasons. Some people say men just want to die earlier. But anyway, but the other side of it is, in women, women are really two individuals. Because of the two X chromosomes that they have, every other cell in a woman is the opposite one of the other X chromosomes has been inactivated. It's called the Lyon hypothesis. So every cell is different. And so women have more autoimmune disease, and perhaps that has something to do with their living longer. Also, they have to tolerate a genetically different individual during pregnancy. So women are protected in their immune system in different ways than men. So the first part of personalized nutrition is gender. Are you a man or are you a woman? That will determine that. Now, the other thing I want to bring your attention to are these little red lines. People have been looking for the obesity gene now for about 20 years. And there are genes on almost every chromosome that have to do with energy conservation, because this is essential to life. If you can't hang on to calories, you're dead. So it's the same thing as keeping your body temperature normal, keeping your water balance normal. This goes throughout evolution. There's a new thing now called short RNAs, and these are little pieces of RNA that you can put into a cell and suppress any gene you want. Turn it off, just like turning off a light switch. And they've done this with worms. And believe it or not, a worm can get obese or a worm can get thin. And it turns out that to prevent the obesity or to prevent the thinness, you have to turn off 300 genes. To turn off the obesity, you only have to turn off 112 genes. So the balance is toward obesity. The balance is toward hanging on to extra calories. That's my point there. And it goes back through evolution, because even worms need to survive. So it's all about balance, and we're going to come back to balance over and over again. The first thing is energy balance. Energy in equals energy out plus energy stored. That's the first law of thermodynamics. Throughout the universe, every star, everything must obey that. We have to obey that too. So if you eat more than you burn, you store the extra as fat. There's just no other way about it. And what I'm going to tell you, though, is it doesn't matter if it's high fat. You know, I knew Nathan Pritikin personally, a great pioneer of preventive and personalized medicine, and he went to the low-fat area, very, very low fat, one chicken breast a week. Well, that turned out to be too little protein. People were hungry all the time. They're eating beans all the time, trying to keep their energy up, you know. And then we went to the Atkins diet. I never knew Atkins personally, but he had this idea, eat cheeseburgers and lose weight, and which is an attractive thought, you know. And that was high fat. And so high fat calories, it doesn't matter whether you take in the extra energy as fat or sugar, as I'll show you in a moment. And then there are some balance factors here that are very important, and it's the type of fat. We're going to come back to that. It turns out that our profit system in the United States has promoted vegetable oils. This goes back to 1938, when they developed something called hybrid corn. Throughout the Midwest, there were lots of apple orchards in the 1800s. As a matter of fact, Johnny Appleseed went around the United States planting apples. And every city had their own little apple. And the reason for this is that cider was the secret alcohol of the 1800s. So everybody had their own little vintage apple cider. And in 1938, hybrid corn was a real economic boon, because what happened was normal corn, one man working 1 acre of land could feed one person for a year. With hybrid corn, one man working 1 acre of land could feed 120 people for a year. So now all of a sudden you had a ton of corn. What are you going to do with all that corn? Well, it took about 10 years from 38 to 48 for the farmers to adopt this. They fed it to cattle, because it takes 17,000 pounds of corn to make a 1,000-pound cow. So that 39-cent a pound hamburger meat in the 1970s was the result of corn being subsidized. That fed our troops in World War II, helped us win the war. But it also, after the war, got turned into Crisco, into all kinds of vegetable oils and shortenings and Mazola that was pouring over the TV set and saying, here, drink this, it'll lower your cholesterol. And the problem was that it actually is a pro-inflammatory fat. So just as we're set to hang on to calories, we're set to be inflamed. This is the last thing in the world you want to pour into your body. That's why I'm such a fan of biodiesel, because I think if they burn that, we won't put it in our bodies. So here are the dietary changes with prosperity, and it's very appropriate on July 4th that we've got red, white, and blue for fat, sugar, and salt here in America, because those are our basic, you know, food groups that we have. We've gone down, actually, in vegetable protein and up in animal protein. And this is a big change. We should be right about here. We should be about 50% animal and vegetable, eating things like soy protein. Starch and fiber are way down. The amount of fiber in America is about 10 grams a day. People should be eating at least 25 grams a day of fiber just to keep the GI tract moving. And I'll talk to you toward the end about how we all have our own little soil with us, which is full of friendly bacteria that need to keep moving and detoxifying your body. And if you're just sitting there reabsorbing those toxins, it's not good for you. And, of course, we need exercise. This is what's wrong, you know. Environmental engineering right here, you know, the escalator to the 24-hour fitness center, one of my favorites. So the result of all this, and about, I remember it was about the time of the last L.A. riots that we had. I was in Baltimore hearing a presentation on the epidemic of obesity. And this was discovered by the epidemiologist who just send people envelopes. They say, write down your weight and your height and send us the envelope back. And what they found was that between 1976, 1980, and 1991 to 1994, there was a rise in the incidence of obesity in America from 25 to 32% of the population was frankly obese. Just by writing down weight and height, and this is a total approximation. I'm going to teach you a better way to determine your personal energy balance in a couple of minutes. But this was a real red light. And today, 65% of Americans are overweight, and about 35% are obese. The very severe obese have quadrupled in number, whereas the average obese have only doubled in number. There are going to be about 300,000 stomach surgeries done this year in America for obesity. We used to do them at UCLA. I've stopped doing them. I'm now in the mode of preventing obesity surgery through diet. Now, this is not an electoral map, but it's a map of the prevalence of obesity. The red states are the fat states. You'll appreciate that. Louisiana, Mississippi, Michigan, and West Virginia in 1991. And then this is the year 2000. Every state in the union, with the exception of Colorado, and Colorado fell in 2001. Greater than 50. And as a matter of fact, this is the least. I love to show this map. The CDC has a map where they've invented more colors and complicated it. They now had to invent a new color of orange for Louisiana and Mississippi because they're over 25%. So this is the view from the left coast, the United States of obesity. And we're exporting this around the world. My books now are in multiple languages. I was just in Thailand, which has a huge problem. Japan, for the first time, has had an increase in adult height and a quadrupling of the rate of obesity. They're now getting breast and prostate cancer, which they never had before. This is just an international epidemic, in China as well, so just around the world. Now, this is an example of where a good invention of technology can actually backfire, and that is right here in 1985, the Japanese discovered something called high fructose corn syrup, and high fructose corn syrup is a bunch of sugar molecules linked together in a big chain. Now, when you drink something, the number of particles that are in that fluid can affect your GI tract. And little babies get, you know, colicky diarrhea and that sort of thing. So it was a nice invention for infant formulas to have these long sugars that would help the babies deal with this very common problem. But the food industry, because of the corn subsidy, this became cheaper than cane sugar. So if you go over to Hawaii, you'll see the sugar cane factories are all rusted over and closed, and corn sugar is being used instead. And you might remember, and now about 33% of it's in soft drinks. And our fat consumption also has gone up in pounds per person. Again, mostly in shortening salad and cooking oils and hidden fats. Margarine never was much of a winner. You know, with all the advertising they did on margarine, the sales are pretty flat. Butter, pretty flat. People know the obvious sources of fat. What you don't know is when you get those wonderful chocolate chip cookies and things that there's a lot of fat in there. And I like to say they're so soft you can hang wallpaper with them. They're really full of fat. These are all the foods that failed last year at the 99-cent store in Los Angeles, and most of them are colorful, but they're colorful candies. They're the wrong kinds of foods. And you probably remember this cola. It might have been 25 cents in 1970. Now you can get this big gulp, or you can get a big 79-cent gallon of cola. Children today might be having 5 servings of cola a day at 150 calories a pop, 750 calories of pure sugar. And this is a real issue, especially for our Hispanic youth. Pediatricians like Fran Kaufman, for the first time, 30% of their waiting room are children with type 2 diabetes. This is adult onset diabetes occurring in children. Those kids are going to get heart disease in their 30s, and a lot of it is due to this. And, of course, again, portion size. The double burger with cheese, 1,120 calories. That's all the calories a small woman needs for the whole day. Now, why do we sell this? Because this is what sells. The expectation of an American consumer going into a restaurant is that they're going to get a doggy bag. If they spent $5.95 for something, they want to take home a doggy bag. They don't want to have small portions. You go to other countries in the world. Go to France. You go to other places. People dine. They eat small amounts of tasty foods. That's not the American way. We want a lot of quantity, and we like things to taste the same. You know, when I was a kid growing up, every burger, you know, you take your life in your hands to get, you know, nobody wanted a hamburger. It was like the last meat you wanted to eat because you could get sick half the time. Then McDonald's came out and invented a burger that tasted the same every single time. And the reason it tastes the same is you're actually tasting the burned fat on the surface of the burger, which hides a lot of the other tastes. So what you're tasting is the rancid fat. Originally, the French fries were made with lard when they were started out in Pasadena, I think was the first one. And at room temperature, the French fries would just stand up, you know. they didn't need Viagra. They just were very stiff all on their own, you know. And then people heard that lard might be bad for you in the 80s, so they decided to switch to hydrogenated soybean oil, the trans fatty acids. And these act just like saturated fat, so at room temperature, again, they were stiff. And you needed that because the French fries are made at a very high temperature. They're at such a high temperature that the water on the inside of the French fry actually explodes, depositing the potato on the outside of the French fry just as it browns. That's how they make a perfect French fry. And they've got it down to a science. And that, not only that, but they also add in a little bit of natural flavoring, as it's called by the FDA. And this is actually a beef hide extract. And that's in the French fry that gives it its very special taste. And you can smell this, you know, from miles away. And again, it's probably genetic that we were all drawn to rotting carcasses in the forest or whatever. But, you know, that's what draws us in. So what's a better way to look at this? Okay, you're going to eat something. So there's a wonderful concept called energy density. That is, I don't know. Well, let me quote Dean Ornish, my good friend. Eat more, weigh less. I guess that's another way to put it. That if you can eat something that fills up your stomach and sends a nice message to your brain, and you don't get a lot of calories, and you get some health, that would be the way to eat. So if you look at different things here, butter, peanut butter, chocolate candy, they're very high in energy density, the number of calories per gram. But if we look at fruits and vegetables down here, they are very low in calories per bite compared to this. And all the fruits and vegetables are under 100 calories per cup. Whereas grains are 250 calories a cup. So a medium potato, 220 calories. No, they're high because they're mostly refined carbohydrate. And they do have sugar added as well. So if you look at a little cereal package, you'll see that there are quite a few calories per bite. Incidentally, while we're on the topic of cereals and grains and potatoes, it turns out that the white potato was developed in the year about 1600. For the original potato was purple on the outside and yellow on the inside. It came from Peru. And it was turned into a white potato because it was a high-yield vegetable, or root tuber, actually, very similar to what happened with a high-yield corn 300 and something years later. They were trying to feed starving people in Europe. That potato could not protect itself against pests as well as the purple potato could, and you had the Irish potato famine. So a lot of the decisions that we make that are expedient to feed people often end up backfiring. So the water content, the higher the water content, the lower the calorie content per bite. So what can you do now for energy balance? Very simple. Number one, eat less high-fat, high-sugar foods. Easy to do. Number two, eat more fruits and vegetables. And you'll see me filling up my plate over here this morning. We had that lovely salmon, and I just filled up the rest of the plate with lots of fruits and vegetables, very little in the way of refined grains. Now, you can contrast that with what I call the United Airlines lunch, you know, which or breakfast, which would be, you know, scrambled eggs and pancakes and toast and, you know, and it goes on, and bacon and sausage, and it goes on and on. No offense to it. I'm a million-mile flyer, so it's okay. But anyway. And so eat less refined grains, and you'll see refined grains everywhere because they are cheap to make. The corn is subsidized, the corn oil is subsidized, the sugar is subsidized, so why not? How do you think they make a 99-cent burger? By simply using cheap ingredients. So there's no question the cost of poor food is much less than the cost of good food. And actually, my friend Adam Dernowski did a study on this in France because the USDA would not release the cost of foods to him in the United States. That was confidential. It was classified. So he did the study in France, and sure enough, the least expensive foods are the ones that have the most sugar and the most fat, as you would expect. Exercise regularly, aerobic and resistance exercise. We just built a special gym in my center that has an air compressor that you push against and actually exactly measures the strength of any body part. And it's a wonderful new exercise lab. And we also have it for aerobic fitness, breath-by-breath oxygen analysis. We have something called a bod pod where you don't have to go underwater anymore. It's a little shell that you step into. You sit on a little bench. You displace air, and it tells you the density of your body because, of course, fat floats in water. So your density of your body tells you the percent fat in your body. So there are many ways to determine your strength, your energy balance point, and your protein needs. I'm going to show you, here's one of the most portable ones. I have about 35 of these machines I carry around. It's called a bioelectrical impedance meter, and I wrote about it in my LA Shape Diet book and gave all the science references to it. What basically the body, the muscle is about 70% water and conducts electricity. Fat is an insulator and doesn't. So putting four little EKG electrodes on your hands and feet, we can estimate within about 5% your lean body mass, that's how much muscle you have in your body, which tells me how much protein you need per day, and then how many calories you burn per day, because fat doesn't burn very many calories, but protein does. So the more muscle you have, the more calories you burn. So a typical man might burn 2,000 calories. His wife, who say has 100 pounds of lean mass, would burn 1,400 calories. They both go on the same diet. He loses weight, and she doesn't. And the reason is she burns fewer calories, so she needs to further restrict her calories. And we have a program at UCLA where we actually do medically supervised dieting. If you go below 1,000 calories a day, you need to be followed by a doctor. And we actually do that for women very, very carefully because it's important. They'll never lose weight. If you put a woman who burns 1,400 calories on 1,400 calories a day, she's in perfect energy balance. She's not going to burn any fat. If I put a man with 2,000 calories a day on 1,200, he'll still burn that other 800 calories. That's the first law of thermodynamics. But that 800 calories will come from the body fat. So I say it's like walking through Bob's Big Boy backwards. Okay. So this is a typical output that we get. We find out your percent body fat, how much lean you have, and this tells me that this person needs to eat about 100 grams of protein a day. What is 100 grams of protein? Well, a 3-ounce chicken breast is about 25 grams. 3-ounce, 4-ounce piece of fish, about 25 grams of protein. And then you can read the protein on soy protein shakes and protein powders and personalize your protein. So you can build a diet for yourself by knowing your body composition, how much lean you have and how much fat you have. That tells me a rough estimate of your resting metabolic rate. And every once in a while, we get a doubting Thomas, and a guy will come in who has a PhD in physiology. Oh, I don't believe that. And we have this space mask we put him under for 15 minutes, measure how much oxygen goes in and how much carbon dioxide comes out, and we're usually within about 50 calories, which is close enough for government work. So this actually works very, very well. And then we build the diet around protein, fruits, vegetables, and then whole grains as calories allow. So I'll usually give women 1 to 3 servings of whole grains a day, which is about 100 to 300 calories, and a man might have 4 or 5. But it really depends on your energy balance and how much you exercise. Now, what about meal replacements? I really did some of the original research on this, and this has been an evolving field. The original meal replacements were just chocolate milk, basically. Lots of sugar, and you could take them in a can. Actually, the earliest one is a product that no longer exists, so I can talk about it. It's Metrical. It goes way, way back to, and I think it was a Mead Johnson product, you know, Metrical. You drink. When you drink, you don't think you're eating. When my son was 10 years old, I got to go down to Dodger training camp and put Tommy Lasorda on one of these meal replacements. My son thought he was actually going to pitch to the Dodgers. He came down in full uniform. I was lucky to get him into the building, but anyway. So Tommy, as you know, lost 50 pounds, put it back on, and walked around, and, you know, if I can do it, you can do it, that kind of thing. But these meal replacements, what they basically do is when you're not hungry, people still eat. And so this gives you an opportunity for a breakfast or a lunch where you're at work or sometime that you don't care about having a delicious meal. You have this meal replacement. It gives you the energy you need. You get the protein, the vitamins, and the minerals. And you can make up your own. I make my own shake in the morning with soy protein and wonderful pomegranate extract, which I add, as well as some frozen blueberries and things. Everybody has their own recipes. As a matter of fact, Stuart gave me a new recipe that he has just developed, and he's all excited about it. And, you know, that's what's so cool because this is something, you know, a man, a can, and a plan, right? So men don't cook. But, you know, you get a blender. You know, I burned out 4 blenders the first year I did this. You get into the high-tech blender area, you know, so you buy really heavy-duty blenders. And no matter how tired I am, I can get up in the morning, put my soy milk in, and throw this in, and I'll do it. And it gives you a great feeling of self-reliance because you're not looking, oh, what's for breakfast? What are we going to get? What are they going to put in front of me for breakfast? I've got my own breakfast thing. So that's a really good thing you can do. And then you can use these 25-gram portions to just multiply up for what you need. So if you're at 100 grams, you're a woman who burns 1,400 calories, 4 servings a day of protein. A man burning 2,100 calories, 6 servings a day of protein. And it works out really, really well. And it's all detailed in my book, which is in multiple languages. So now let's get into the futuristic science fiction stuff, nutrigenetics and nutrigenomics. You all know that the human genome was sequenced. What you don't know is that it only was about 4 people that they did. There are 4 billion bases. It's 4 billion chemical codes. It's like a deck of cards with 4 billion cards that we each carry around in our body. 90% of those are never used. 90% of those cards are never dealt. Only about 10% actually do anything other than regulate the expression of that 10%. What that DNA is then turned into is something called RNA, which is just a mirror image. It's as if you were to make a copy of a DVD. So you made a DVD and you copy that DVD. All that information now goes into a copy called RNA. And then that RNA goes to a little factory, and I'll show you a picture of it. It's called a ribosome. It's a little car factory that the stuff goes in one end, and out the other end come proteins. And they're special RNAs for all the common amino acids, which are the building blocks of protein. They link onto them, they bring them into this factory, and line them up in the right order to make all of the proteins in our bodies. And there are millions and millions of proteins in our bodies, possibly billions. And then these proteins are very interesting because they then act in pathways. So just like we have freeways made of concrete, we have metabolic pathways that direct all the metabolites in our body along certain lines. So how do you burn sugar? How do you get energy out of sugar? Very complicated metabolic maps. In addition to that, genes aren't always turned on. Our genes are mostly turned off. They only turn on when they need to be turned on, and then they're turned off again. If genes are turned on all the time, that's what happens in tumor cells. You don't want your genes on all the time. These little red discs are proteins called histones. And this is supposed to be the DNA, this long coil. It's a cartoon. Here's that chromosome we talked about. And chromosomes have long arms and short arms. And then if we were to spin out of that chromosome, it's got tied into it these coils of DNA. And in the coils are these red proteins called histones. And they are in a certain chemical form called acetylated. And then this little group is taken off, and then that makes the protein come out and allows the DNA to open up so that now can be translated, and the body can then read this code. And that's what happens all the time in your body. So this is the little factory here that takes this coded thing, and each one of these obligates a particular amino acid to be put into a protein. And then you build this protein, which is all these helical things here, which are so amazing, and they have little pockets that receive particular chemicals in your body. And all of this evolved when we were in equilibrium with plants. So much of what we have in our body are genes and proteins that interact with plants. Now, what is the biggest problem that plants had on this planet? And it really goes back to when the first primitive bacteria grew billions of years ago. If you've been to the Grand Canyon, you can see the first forms of life. They have a museum there. And it's just this sludge that's there. And what happened was the sludge took in carbon dioxide and made oxygen. And what happens is when oxygen hits sunlight, and this is where it fits in with our environmental talk of yesterday, when oxygen hits sunlight, it creates what's called an oxygen radical, which is an oxygen atom that has an extra unpaired electron that can then destroy all those wonderful things I showed you in the cell. And so the plants had to do something because as soon as they filled up the atmosphere with oxygen, they started burning up. And you can see this in your house plants. If you don't give them proper nutrition, they'll turn white and then brown and they'll burn. So reactive oxygen species actually turn out to be used by the body in low doses. We use them in our bodies to kill bacteria. We use them in our bodies to help our cells grow. And they're actually a signal. For instance, in the pancreas, the cells that secrete insulin in the pancreas have no defense against oxygen. And that's why they burn out in diabetes, because those cells have to release insulin on a minute-by-minute basis as your blood glucose changes. And so to have that responsiveness, they use oxygen as a signal, almost like you use electricity in a computer. In a larger amount, we can actually inhibit cell growth. And this is how we believe that with pomegranate and other fruits and vegetables that we stop growth. And then at high doses, you actually kill cells. And that's how radiation and chemotherapy will kill cancer cells, is actually by creating these oxygen radicals. That's how it works. So our bodies actually have an interaction, which is nutrigenomics. You are what you eat, not only in terms of what you store, but how your body reacts to what you eat. So you're not the same person once you start eating 7 servings a day of fruits and vegetables. Your body turns on certain genes that weren't turned on before. And those people who don't eat fruits and vegetables, which are a lot of Americans, who eat an average of 3 a day, 1.5 of which are French fries and potatoes, those people don't have these things turned on. So a lot of the things we find in foods like curcumin, resveratrol, I'll talk to you about a lot of the natural plant nutrients, go into the cell, and what they do is they go into the DNA and they turn on the synthesis of specialized proteins that protect you from this oxygen. And so just like the cell protected itself by developing color, it also protected itself by developing antioxidant enzymes. And every one of us here in this room has those protective enzymes. Now, the other example besides that that I want to talk to you about is folate, folic acid. You've all heard of folic acid in vitamins. The word folate means leaf. It is green leaf. And when people moved to Northern Europe, I talked to you about how all of the folic acid was geared toward the germplasm, the sperm and ova DNA to protect reproduction, and kind of left the rest of us hanging in terms of heart disease. So it turns out if you don't have enough folate, you have an increased risk of heart disease and cancer. And folic acid silences the expression of abnormal genes. And I'm going to show you now an amazing thing. So what happened basically here is that as these nutrients became limiting, you had to save them for the germplasm. Now, there's a yellow mouse called the agouti mouse, and this mouse is obese, and this mouse gets cancer, and it gets diabetes, and it has a reduced lifespan. And it has actually an abnormal gene that makes a protein in the brain that inhibits a normal protein from regulating the appetite of that mouse, and so the mouse gets big and fat. Now, if you take one of these yellow agouti mice, and she's pregnant with little babies, and you give her a whole bunch of folic acid, what you actually find out is she doesn't have yellow babies. She has normal brown babies that never become obese, never get cancer, and age normally. So folic acid during pregnancy can prevent birth defects. And we know this from our research in people, because women will have babies who have no brains or have no spinal cord. It's called spina bifida. And it's well known that taking a vitamin with 400 micrograms a day of folic acid will prevent this. But the government refuses to recognize the health benefits of vitamins. They just had, believe it or not, an NIH conference, which I refused to participate in, which was on the health benefits of vitamins. And they were trying to have like a jury and a consensus. And, you know, it's all run by the food industry. And I don't know why the food industry is so paranoid about vitamins, because it's food plus vitamins. Taking a supplement, there's nothing wrong with you. Eat a healthy diet and you take a supplement. If your diet is absolutely perfect, the supplements won't hurt you, because if you get 100% of what you need in the diet, 100% of what you need in the supplement, that's 200%. Nothing is toxic at 200%, as I'll show you. So folic acid is one of the most powerful things we have out there to prevent cancer. My friend Bruce Ames talks about how in lower socioeconomic groups, they don't get enough folic acid. He can get urine samples from people and show that their cells are not protected from cancer because they don't have this very inexpensive vitamin that we could do as a public health maneuver throughout our society. So what happens in the uterus is very important, and this is one of the hottest areas of nutrition now. It's called genetic programming. And what happens is there's a fellow named Barker in England who came up with this hypothesis that babies that are born small are destined to become obese as adults. And it was kind of the opposite of what people thought. But actually what happens is the baby in the uterus already develops certain genes to hang on to nutrition if the mother's not eating enough. And Native Americans had painless childbirth because they had little tiny babies. And those babies, if they're then exposed to a high-fat diet, will develop obesity. And this is where the story of the Tarahumara Indians comes in, which you've probably heard before, where in northern Mexico, there are Tarahumara or Pima Indians who've lived the way they did 12,000 years ago. They have very little diabetes, about 6% of the population. Most of them very well adapted to starvation. They wash their clothes in a stream. Their very same relatives, blood relatives, live in southern Arizona, where the government blocked their river, ruined their agricultural lifestyle with a dam. And now they sell something called lard bread off the roadside. They love fat. They love sugar. They have an 80% incidence of diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease, to the point that the government built a research center there to study these unfortunate Native Americans. And we're repeating that experiment now in Hispanic youth in Southern California who have the same genes. Now, what's really interesting in animals is that you do this thing in utero where you adapt the baby to a starvation economy. Now the baby's born and is subject to obesity. Those genes are now heritable for 8 generations. They've only gone out 8 generations so far. So you've permanently changed the genome. So all of us, our genes for inflammation and for obesity that occurred, I don't know when, maybe the year 1700, they said there were 20,000 founder genes in Eastern Europe. Who knows where those genetic changes in response to external environment, those are permanent now. And we have to adapt our diet in a personal way to meet those genes. So our genes are from one environment, and this developmental programming in the future, personalized nutrition, will involve knowledge of your individuality based on your genome. But not just your genome, that's the blueprint of the house. It doesn't tell you where the furniture is in the kitchen. And modifications which occurred through epigenetic changes in utero, that was those proteins that opened up the DNA or closed the DNA, and what happened to you during early childhood, during the first few years of life. So again, we get back to the idea of balance. And there's a lot of arguments. I'm not going to take you through all the technology right now. Different people are competing into how this is going to be worked out. We have a nanotechnology project at UCLA where people are making little chips that measure your RNA, your DNA, and your protein. They want to stack them up like an Intel computer and, you know, push this thing through. Nobody knows exactly how this is going to work right now. I just went to a workshop at the Institute of Medicine on nutrigenomics. It's still not known. But the application idea is really brilliant, that everyone will know what their personal nutrition should be, and that for research it'll be really great because, you know, in nutrition we always have conflicting studies. Something worked, something didn't work, this causes cancer, this doesn't, it's enough to drive you to drink. So the idea is to kind of rationalize all this by understanding individuality. So nutrition equals food plus supplements. Vitamins and minerals that are optimal, not minimal. We still talk about the RDA or the basic requirement. Carbohydrates and fiber, talking about how do those interact with your body. So you want not refined carbohydrates that stimulate a lot of insulin, but unrefined carbohydrates. Proteins, adequate for optimal health, not the minimum so that you don't become protein deficient, but how much do you need to build muscle if you're lifting weights? Fats, we want to balance the omega-3 and omega-6. I haven't talked much about that. These are the healthy fish oil fats. Fish get them by eating algae, so I like to say if you can't be a vegetarian, eat a vegetarian. Okay? Because basically you're going to get those things that they ate. The omega-6 are largely coming from vegetable oils that are polluting our diet. The plants have about a 3-to-1 ratio of omega-6 to omega-3. Our bodies in America, if you're eating an American diet, are about 30-to-1. So we're polluted with this. So this is where getting on a low-fat diet and increasing your fish oil. So I take 3 grams of fish oil every day, and I eat a very low-fat diet. I take in no gratuitous fat or sugar. That's how I like to look at it. If I want to have something that tastes good in a small portion, I'll certainly have it. But then I'll notice, you know, are they piling up? Am I getting too much? And kind of keep an eye on it. And then colorful phytochemicals and probiotics are the last two topics I'm going to talk about today. All of these things represent what you put in your cells. You burn some of it to carbon dioxide and water. Exercise helps you do that. The unburned metabolites convert to stored tissue products, and that's why you are what you eat. I can go into your body fat and take a sample out, and I can tell who's been eating fish oils and who hasn't, because the fish oils actually will accumulate in your body fat over about a year period of time. And for many other things, you know, B vitamins and stuff, they come out in your urine. We now have a test for pomegranate where I can tell if you had your pomegranate juice today or you didn't, because we found a chemical that the body takes the natural plant nutrients from the pomegranate, takes it to the liver, puts a couple little chemicals on it, excretes it in the urine, only on the day that you drank your pomegranate juice. It's gone by the next day. So if you haven't taken it and you're in one of my studies, I can tell by urine sample, did you behave yourself or didn't you? And we know that. And so this is what we call cellular nutrition and balancing it. So there's an internal environment, and the internal environment, inflammation protects you from infections. Nutrition and sanitation reduce the need for these defense mechanisms. And we've lived far beyond the age of reproduction, so we are not selected for less inflammation or for not holding on to calories, because all of that was from an earlier era. And then excess inflammation with aging leads to heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's disease, and just about any chronic disease of aging that you want to talk about. So balancing is the key. Balancing essential fats in foods promotes health and prevents disease. Balancing the calories helps as well. Now, this is a little complex, but I had the privilege of meeting David Baltimore through Faster Cures, and he invented this protein called NF-kappa-B. And that's enough to intimidate anybody right there. And I asked him why it had such a horrible name. And he was studying immune cells at the time, and your immune cells, there's a type of immune cell you have called a B cell, which makes antibodies. We have B cells and T cells. And he was studying the B cells, and they make a light chain called a kappa chain. And then NF means nuclear factor. And what he found was that in these immune cells, this protein would come from this inside part of the cell into the nucleus, bind to the DNA for the first time. He was the first one to ever describe that. And once it bound to the DNA, it would turn on a whole bunch of genes of inflammation in this particular immune cell, one of which were these light chains in the B cell. It turns out not only immune cells have NF-kappa-B, every cell in the body has NF-kappa-B. And this NF-kappa-B is turned on by any kind of an inflammatory signal. Exposure to sunlight. You know, I wore a hat and sunglasses on the way over here today. That will turn on the NF-kappa-B in your skin if you're exposed to sun. It's what causes inflammation. But it is so regulated. I said we weren't built like a 56 Chevy. This stuff sits inactive in the cytoplasm of your cell, inside the membrane. As some impulses, inflammatory impulses, come in to the membrane, what happens is that these things are chemically modified so that they release these two proteins to go into the nucleus. And then what happens, it turns itself off again. In just a few seconds, it turns off, and you're back to normal again. You've responded to the inflammation, and you're done. But if you have a cancer cell, this thing sits here and sits here and sits here. And if you have other autoimmune diseases like lupus, it will sit there. Rheumatoid arthritis, Alzheimer's disease, NF-kappa-B is upregulated. So in every inflammatory disease you can think of, this molecule that David Baltimore discovered is the key molecule. Well, what we found is that a number of natural plant products, the first one listed there is ellagic acid, which comes from the pomegranate, curcumin, which comes from curry powder, ECGC, see, the palm queen is up here, ECGC for green tea, the omega-3 fatty acids, and quercetin, which is found in onions and other kinds of vegetables. All of these things inhibit the activation of NF-kappa-B here, turning it on. And now what we found with pomegranate, which is very exciting, it actually inhibits the binding to the DNA. It actually inhibits that last step. So I'm going to write a big project for NCI, which they're not going to be able to afford to fund, but we're going to include David Baltimore in it. And we're going to take this little machine apart and find out where these things work. Because my problem right now is that everything does everything. All my colors are equally good. They all work. The question is, how do they work and how do they work together? And we did some work on a Chinese herb called PC Spez, where we had 8 different herbs, and we did a kind of analysis where we could tell which ones were canceling out, which ones were adding. We're going to do the same thing with fruits and vegetables now. And so this is the great opportunity for health. What does color have to do with it? It represents the majority of phytonutrients. Now, we have a brown, beige, or white diet generally. I was working with one of the big vegetable fruit companies, which will remain unnamed, and they took my 7 groups, shrunk it to 5, and made a white group for bananas. So there are a lot of economic incentives about which fruits and vegetables are produced. And here's a lot of the different chemical structures of things that are found. We grow 40% of the world's tomatoes in the Sacramento Valley, lycopene, very important. Broccoli, which we've had a lot of, sulforaphane, indole-3-carbinol from cabbage, garlic, chili peppers, ginger, all these wonderful spices that were so common. And here are the pomegranate ellagitannins. These are amazing. These, compared to what you just saw, are much larger. This is a molecular weight of 1,000. It's the largest of these molecules known to man. It can't be absorbed into the body intact. The little red part here breaks off and comes into the bloodstream. That's the ellagic acid. And we've measured that in humans. We know how long it lasts in the blood. We know what it's converted into, how it comes out in the urine. And we found that there are some individual variations in how people break down the pomegranate. So we're studying now the genetics of that. So people eat food, not nutrients. Because when I talk to my oncology friends about green tea, they say, oh, Dave, why don't you just go produce an ECGC capsule? We'll patent it, you know. And we'll come back to this with vitamin D, because I'm now taking 2,000 international units a day of vitamin D. Good. You know everything. Anyway, for a long time, don't take vitamin D. It'll cause your calcium to go up. And I have a very good friend at Cedars who works on vitamin D analogs at drug companies. None of them have worked out. All of them are patentable. People don't eat drugs. There were no drugs 50,000 years ago. All the enzymes I told you about evolved to deal with the 25,000 phytochemicals in fruits and vegetables that we need to metabolize. Now, that's not saying that you don't need a drug once in a while. You do need an antibiotic if you have an infection. Drugs are very useful. But most of the drugs that are being marketed today are for lifestyle diseases. And for lifestyle diseases, diet and exercise are much, much more important. So eating whole foods is often better than the single isolated compound. We know this from research that we've done. And the different colors interact together. And pomegranates in the red-purple group, together with cranberries, blueberries, raspberries. And my book, What Color Is Your Diet, will outline for you what are your choices. And there are lots of them here in all the different color groups. Now, because we're so well evolved, it may be that some colors can substitute for others. The Chinese don't eat tomatoes because they're very confused about tomatoes. It turns out the New York Port Commissioner in the 1800s classified tomatoes as a vegetable. Botanically, they're a fruit because they have seeds. But you could charge a tariff on a fruit, but you couldn't charge a tariff on a vegetable. So the Supreme Court in the 1800s, by a 5-4 decision, declared the tomato a vegetable. There's a recorded, I could get you the reference, there's actually a Supreme Court decision declaring the tomato to be a vegetable. So the Chinese were confused. Well, you put sugar on it for dessert, what do you do? So their lycopene levels as a result are just about zero, yet they substitute lutein or something else for this. So for these natural plant nutrients, they're antioxidants, they're anti-carcinogens, they enhance your immune system at the nutritional to supra-nutritional doses. And then at very, very high doses, if you take 500, 1,000 times, then they become toxic and they can actually be used as therapy or drugs. So you can start to use them as drugs at very, very high doses. And this is why people say, oh, be careful, you know, those herbs will kill you, you know. And there are a lot of people, you know, watch out, you know, those will kill you. So now I've backed off of herbs for a while and I'm working on fruits and vegetables because they're known to be healthy. So politically, it's much, much better. And I'm not kidding about this. At the NIH, it's a big problem with herbs now. And I think the future of herbs in America is pretty much doomed because they haven't issued the good manufacturing practices. Since 1992, when the Deshaies legislation was passed, the FDA has not issued good manufacturing practices. And the reason for that is that once they are manufactured correctly, you can't say they're poison. And there are two groups of people who want to say they're poison. One is the big pharma group, and the other group are the people who have very small vitamin companies that are running out of their RV, and they can't afford a quality control department. And so one group of politicians is protecting them, and another group of politicians is protecting the other group. So I think fruits and vegetables is really the future. Now I just want to say a word about probiotics, and then I'm going to open it up to questions. The internal environment. We also carry around our own bacteria. You may not know this, but plants produce, take in CO2, and they produce oxygen. And they're very sophisticated. They actually just went a different direction of evolution than we did. There's a group at UCLA of plant geneticists, and they sequenced corn and found in the corn DNA many human genes, and tons of them. And these things are, they send out little messages here in the soil. The soil is kind of their world, and the roots send out a message. They use luteolin, which is one of the fruit and vegetable natural plant nutrients. And it attracts a type of bacteria from the soil because the soil is mostly made up of bacteria. In our greenhouse, we have a $7 million greenhouse at UCLA called the UCLA Plant Growth Center. And it was built as part of our botanical grant that we had. And in there, we had to sterilize the soil before we brought it in the greenhouse because soil carries bacteria. So we had to put UV light on in order to be able to study things that we wanted to study. And what will happen is they will attract what are called nitrogen-fixing bacteria. For instance, soybean and other beans will attract a certain species of bacteria to the root. It'll then interact with the root, again, gene-nutrient interaction, just like a human, and it'll form a little node on here, and it'll form nitrogen in the soil. And every farmer knows that beans and soybeans don't need fertilizer. They make their own by getting nitrogen-fixing bacteria to come in here. And they not only get them to come in, but they put out repellents to keep the other guys from coming in. So these plant roots are in an active discussion with the soil all the time, getting the healthy bacteria in and the bad bacteria out. Now, we evolved in a different direction. We carry around our own soil. We have 10 to the 14th bacteria that we carry around in our large colon. Some of these are friendly and some of them are not. And if you don't eat enough fiber and you don't keep that well irrigated, you don't push out the bad bacteria. And Danon now has come out with these probiotic products that are healthy yogurts, and these go back to researchers in Russia and all over the world who've looked at fermented milk. It actually goes back to the time of Abraham that he drank fermented goat's milk. And fermented milk products, because of these bacteria, have a health benefit. And most of your immune system is on your GI tract and your small intestine. So the bacteria that you have determine a lot of your health. And there are theories that we become so clean in our environment that we haven't reacted to outside things, so we have more autoimmune diseases. And there are people in Scandinavia treating eczema and allergies and asthma with these probiotics. So these are good things to have, and it's kind of another area of the future of personalized nutrition is probiotics. So to really simplify it, we're going to be obtaining information on what are called genetic polymorphisms. That's how you're different from the person sitting next to you. And how proteins and RNA define individual responses to nutritional intervention. I do have bad news for you. There will be no cheeseburger gene. Common sense. There are people out there who really think we're going to find a gene that will let people eat whatever they want. I think a better way is to actually change the cheeseburger. There are people doing that. You can make them taste good and still be healthy. Some will benefit more than others from nutritional changes, and that's what we're finding. About half the people in this audience are missing a gene for metabolizing broccoli, and the other half of you have the gene. Well, it turns out that if you eat broccoli 3 times a week, everyone is protected about 20% from colon cancer. But the people who are missing the gene are actually protected by 50%, because it turns out they're missing that gene, they get a higher level of the natural plant nutrient, that stimulates other genes to come up, and they're more protected. So sometimes when you're missing a gene, it's better for you. If you have a gene, it's better for you. This is a very complex story that will be evolving over a period of time. So you need to know what to do now, and no more one-size-fits-all recommendations. You know, they used to have the US RDA, which was for a 30-year-old pregnant male. And this was on the side of every cereal box in America, because there are different requirements for a man, a woman, a child, a big person, a little person. So I've tried to give you a little idea of how you personalize to your lean body mass, your energy balance. And then don't be so worried about the exact amount of fruits and vegetables you have to eat. Those enzymes for metabolizing the natural plant nutrients, they're easily upregulated. Your body, you know, eat 3 apples, eat 5 apples, your body will take care of it. There's no problem. Eat 3,000 apples, you may have a problem. Okay, so when you take your supplements, take them in amounts that are comparable to what you would get in the diet. Okay, and then improvements in research outcomes. I'm hoping nutrition research will move, because right now we're dependent on people doing these paper and pencil research, the epidemiology studies, which are just not cause and effect. They're just association. When you read in the paper every week that such and such is associated with a benefit or not, and it changes, that's because these aren't cause and effect studies. We do cell culture studies, animal models, clinical studies, and these are the most expensive, or clinical trials, and we really have a limited number of those. So what other future things can we talk about briefly? Well, the pioneering new nanotechnologies. We're going to have implantable biosensors that will put under your skin. It'll be wonderful to monitor your nutritional status at all times. We'll be able to use imaging technologies to identify what's going on within a single cell. And then we're going to have to integrate all this information. At the end of the day, we're going to need mathematical computers that can do this integration of all these pathways that would simply blow your mind. And this will help with drug discovery, cancer genomics, and all of these things. But it's also, I think, nutrition is going to benefit more than any other field. Lee Hood, who's one of the pioneers of systems biology, has said that nutrition will be one of the greatest beneficiaries of this new field, as will what's called pharmacogenomics, knowing which person will react differently to a drug. So what you can do now, I've tried to tell you, balance your calories through physical activity and food choices for health, and take supplements. Anti-inflammation via fish oils, reduced fat intake, and natural plant nutrients from fruits and vegetables. I really recommend everybody increase their vitamin D intake to 1,000 to 2,000 IU a day. Check with your doctor, as always, but he probably won't know about this. Antioxidation through phytochemicals. Immune function and digestive health with probiotics is a new area. And personalization. Right now, we're doing it by what we call phenotype. What's your body shape? How much do you weigh? Tomorrow, we'll be doing it by genotype and epigenotype as well, how your genes are turned on and turned off. Thank you very much for your attention. Yes, Linda, go ahead.
So what about the blood type diets? What do you think of those?
That was, you know, people asked me about that a long time ago. The blood type diet by Adami was a first effort at personalized nutrition. It has nothing to do with nutrition. The blood types were developed to defend against cholera. It turns out if you had certain blood types, you were less likely to get cholera. But by, you know, when people have the intention to change their diet and restrict calories, they lose weight on almost any diet. And there have been studies now that show the most important thing about dieting is sticking with the diet, not the diet that you did. Now, I still feel that some diets are healthier than other diets. Where you ultimately want to get to is this diet I talked about and lose weight in a healthy way. But if somebody gets all excited about something and it was their sense of ownership of that diet, it works. And that's why the blood type diet works. They all work for a period of time. Yes?
I was a Secretary of Agriculture during the Clinton
administration. Oh, good.
But I'm a convert to what you're saying.
You actually arranged the debate between Atkins and Dean Ornish that I was invited to and couldn't go to.
Well, I was there. There were more cameras at that debate than there were in any other administration hearing for the entirety that shows the interest of people in these buildings. Can I just make a question a little bit about, you mentioned most doctors won't know anything about this. You know, the fact of the matter is most people get their information through their health care providers.
I know.
And so what can you do to try to improve the quality of knowledge so that a doctor won't just prescribe medicine but will try to do a lifestyle change other than you need to lose weight?
I won an election, actually. I hate to make a joke about Al Gore, but I used to wear an Al Gore mask to the obesity meetings. But I finally won an election after I'm chair of the Medical Council of the American Society for Nutrition. What happened is the American Society for Nutrition has now merged the international nutrition sciences of all the land-grant colleges from USDA, including Davis, and the medical school nutrition, which is the group I was in with American Society of Clinical Nutrition, which has the most widely read journal called American Journal for Clinical Nutrition. And actually what I'm doing is I'm right now working on a merger between UC Davis and UCLA for the California Clinical Nutrition Research Unit. So the American Society for Nutrition is wanting to bring in the nutrition scientists and the medical schools together. And I've been at UCLA Medical School for over 20 years trying to get nutrition into the curriculum, and it's been a real uphill fight. And then the economic, and I created my own pyramid actually in 1997 called the California Cuisine Pyramid with fruits and vegetables at the bottom, which, as you know, the USDA subsidy for fruits and vegetables is about 4.5% of the budget, whereas most of it went more for refined grains, which was reasonable to feed the population when undernutrition was a problem. But it's like the way we redesigned our cars and automobiles. We now need to redesign our diet and now start to incentivize people in the Midwest to grow fruits and vegetables as opposed to as much grains, unless we're going to use those grains for fuel. So I think there's a whole area here, but I didn't mean to vilify the USDA at all. Great. It's great to meet you, and it's a delayed meeting. I was actually writing a grant, as I usually am, and couldn't come to that debate, so thank you for putting that on. Yes?
The study you did with the worms, the obese and the thin ones, just one question on that. Is it the case that the genetic changes change the, what we call it in physics, mechanical efficiency? In other words, I don't suspect you had an active worm and a sedentary worm. You let them do the same activities. So the mechanical efficiency was actually changed by the genetics?
Yeah, it has to do with energy efficiency, and you can also study this in fruit flies if you want to. You can study it in mice. And you can study it in people. There was actually a study in Science that was very amusing. Somebody put sensors into the underwear of obese people. And they measured how much they moved around. And there are actually, and studies were done on starvation years ago. Ansel Keys, during World War II, conscientious objectors in World War II, went into a study we'd never do today where he has two volumes that I read in medical school on all the adaptations to starvation. And part of it is reduced movement. There's actually depression, isolation. There are mental changes that go on with starvation, all geared toward conserving energy. So we have, yeah.
Is it reduced activity?
Both.
Or is it the rate at which energy is burned for the same activity?
It's both. It's both more efficient storage of energy, less burning of activity. It's both. Yes?
You mentioned the probiotics and some of the allergy treatments going on. What do you know about the increased rate of nut allergies in children? And if there are any new information about what's causing it? And if there's any breakthrough treatments around the world?
What normally happens is, as you're exposed to foreign antigens, many of them in the GI tract, you know, kids, like my kids when they were small, when they first ate tomatoes, they got a little red rash on their face for a couple of days, and then the rash disappeared. What happens is you develop tolerance to commonly seen antigens. And it turns out that nuts and shrimp, for some reason, are the most common food allergies, and they have very unusual antigens. so that if your immune system as a child is not exposed to a lot of different antigens early, that you have a higher incidence of these allergic hyperresponsive phenomena. Some of it has to do with the genetics of the immune system. Those immune responses are something called IgE. Mediated, and they're very different responses. So part of it's genetics, and part of it is lifestyle. And I think the lifestyle part is exposing children to these probiotics early in life, and I think we're going to have a lot of new research on that coming up in the future. Also, children don't get the right kind of fats early in life. It turns out that the fish oil fats, there are two kinds. There's EPA and DHA, and it turns out DHA, which is a 22-carbon fish oil, is needed for brain development and eye development, and they've now put it into infant formulas. So we've learned that these things are involved in immune function and in cell development. So infant nutrition, a very, very important area of ongoing research. Yeah?
What's the difference between protein in grains and protein in, say, soy or even milk or meat?
Well, there are many different proteins found, and many of them are high quality. Rice has a protein, believe it or not. They're just the proteins in grains are there in smaller amounts. However, they can be isolated. So peas have protein. There's a pea protein, which is a wonderful high-quality protein, rice protein, soy protein. They're all different proteins. The plant proteins tend to be a little lower in one of the amino acids called methionine than our animal proteins, and that methionine goes into that folic acid pathway. And so studies a long time ago in terms of heart disease in animals have looked at about 50% of the protein being plant and 50% being animal. And the animal protein I really recommend is ocean-caught fish or seafood. And the reason I say seafood is that some of the shrimp, the larger shrimp, are fed vegetable paste. There's a big controversy, again, about, and it's interesting how people distort the facts with farm-fed fish versus ocean-caught fish. People will tell you, oh, farm-fed fish have the same amount of fish oils as ocean-caught fish. That's true. They both have 7 grams. But the farm-fed fish also have another 7 grams of corn oil because they're fed, and it's how they're fed. Yeah, of the corn oil type fatty acid, the omega-6, the pro-inflammatory ones. And they're very high in fat. They have 850 calories in a serving. They're normally gray in color. And they take astaxanthin, which is the pink color, and they have a little painter's thing. And well, they have people like them a little pinker, we'll make them pinker. So they actually go from gray to being more pink. They also get sea lice. But the thing that really turned people off to them is they're contaminated with PCBs. And the environmental pollution, emotional thing, that really cut the sales of farm-fed salmon. So ocean-caught salmon is really what I would recommend. Yeah?
There's a great debate whether soy is good for you.
Oh, yes.
I'd love to know what that is.
Yeah, the great debate about soy. Now, this is interesting. The dairy industry sued the soy industry a few years ago saying you can't call it soy milk. Milk only comes from a cow. You have to call it soy beverage, okay? And it turns out that there's one researcher in Illinois who gave soy protein and these soy phytochemicals to mice with a tumor implanted under the skin, breast tumor implanted under the skin. Now, breast tumors normally don't occur under the back of the mouse. These were human tumors in a mouse that had no immune system. And mice also don't have, and so he took out the ovaries. The mice had no, they don't have the same fat enzymes that women do. So postmenopausal women make estrogen from their body fat. So if you take a very weak estrogen like soy and you put it into this mouse with no ovaries, no estrogens coming out of the fat, and a human breast tumor implanted under the skin, of course the tumor is going to grow just like it would in a culture dish. So this is a culture dish with 4 legs. That was then misinterpreted as saying, well, soy can cause breast cancer. And I found this out in October 1997. It was presented in an American Dietetic Association meeting by this researcher, which is like the worst thing. These poor dietitians had no idea, you know, what's going on. I had women in tears. And how could you do this to us? You actually look at the primate research and you look at all the other human research. One of our oncologists said God already did the clinical trial. 2/3 of the world's population eats soy, and they don't have breast cancer. So if you're eating soy in the normal amounts in the diet that's found in the Japanese diet and other diets, it's perfectly safe. The only thing we don't know is if you take hundreds of times the amount of soy proteins as a tablet, you probably don't want to do that. But if you take a capsule in the amount that's normally eaten, that's probably safe. So and there's another problem here, which is the specialties that people come from. They're what are called toxicologists. So they look at everything as if it were a drug. And if you look at soy as if it were a drug and you start studying it in 4 generations of mice and stuff, you start seeing some changes that have nothing to do with people. And so there's a problem within the scientific community. The Congress doesn't know what to do with it. They get different messages, and there's an economic you know, backdrop to this whole discussion. But for my feeling is soy is perfectly safe. It's a very important protein. You know, if we had amaranth, that would be great. If we had rice protein, that would be great. But we make 51% of the world's soybeans. So let's use that soy protein rather than the soy oil. Let's burn the soy oil as biofuel. Let's use the soy protein for our bodies, because you can make soy burgers out of it. You can make all kinds of wonderful tasting foods that people will want to eat. Okay, I want to be fair here. Yeah, Bill.
Hi. As a doctor, it's sometimes hard to know what to recommend to patients. So I read studies about the benefits of omega-3 fatty acids, of different herbs. The problem is, I don't know what you are buying is what you think you're buying. It's the problem with the lack of regulation. How do you know which brand of fish oil or probiotics or SAMe or whatever you're getting, because there is no regulation.
Right. I think there are a couple, and I don't work with these companies at all, but there are large companies that have quality control departments. I would say you go with the large companies because they have a lot at risk. Let's say they're making a lot of money on supplements, and a lot of their work, by the way, is private label. You don't even know that they're doing it. They're making them for Costco or they're making them for somebody else. But they have a lot at stake, so they have quality assurance companies, quality assurance departments that take care of these things. So the big companies, the Centrums, the Pharmavites, Nature Made, those companies, PLI, any of the big companies are going to have quality assurance people. The bigger problem is, where's the authoritative source? And that's what I'm going to try to do through the American Society of Nutrition. We're going to try to link up with the American Academy of Family Practice, Society for General Internal Medicine. We've done a lot of primary care education at UCLA in our different centers, and we want to do more of that so people have somebody they can trust, because there's so much economics here that the doctors who've been the big spokespeople of nutrition have not had any nutrition training. Okay, let's see, back here in the back. Right. Actually, I know Don McNamara personally from the egg board. He used to be at Rockefeller University. And one of our old, wonderful friend of mine was Roz Alphenslater, who's no longer alive. She used to be called the egg lady at UCLA because she did all the egg studies. She used to feed eggs to medical students and their cholesterol wouldn't go up. The whole thing with cholesterol as a biomarker of heart disease is in question. The cholesterol became the biomarker in the early 1980s. I went to some of the first conferences sponsored by Merck, and I talked about the cellular basis of atherosclerosis. Turns out lowering cholesterol only reduces heart disease risk by 20%. So I say, where about the other 80%? A lot of it's obesity, which only in 1997 was identified as independent risk factor for heart disease. So there are many other factors besides cholesterol. Furthermore, while the egg has cholesterol in it and it has saturated fat in it, eating cholesterol is not where most of your cholesterol comes from. You make your own cholesterol. Mostly in people who are obese have higher insulin levels, and they make triglycerides and cholesterol in their liver. So the egg has been maligned, to answer that question. There's a couple of essential nutrients in the egg, like choline, which you don't get in a lot of other parts of the diet. It was a sign of virtue during the Pritikin era, just not to eat eggs. And I still eat egg beaters. I don't eat egg yellow. I eat egg white, which is a good source of animal protein. It's albumin, one of the highest quality proteins. And I think, as with anything else, in small amounts, it's not a poison. It's not going to hurt you. So I do think the egg has been maligned to some extent. Yeah. Oh, let me just say one more thing. There's only 6 grams of protein, though, in an egg. So you actually need 4 egg whites to get my 25 grams for breakfast. So if you just have one egg and then a bagel and toast, and you're going to be hungry at 10 o'clock looking for the donut truck. Yes. So I heard Craig Venter speak before, and actually I was debating Francis Collins a little bit at this workshop. The genome is only part of the story. Once you know your gene sequence, that's only part of the story. You still need to know about how the genes are translated into proteins, and that's different in different people, because many of the genes code for regulatory proteins, which then behave differently in different people depending on what other proteins they're interacting with. So right now, what we know is, what are the commonalities? People have upregulated inflammation, they have upregulated calorie retention, and they tend to be inactive. So we can do things about that while we wait for that future date. But I don't think any of the tools that are out there right now, they're like genetic epidemiology. They're population studies of genes, which gives you odds ratios. It's like going to the horse track. It doesn't really tell you what is going to happen to you as a person. Well, on average, if you have this gene, this might happen. And on average, this is associated. But it's really a lot of mathematical games. You know, in most research, we talk about 5% of the time the opposite might occur. So if I do a study with two groups, I'll get what's called a p-value of 0.05. That means 5% of the time I'm wrong, even though my study went that way. Turns out in genetics, because they do so many repetitive things, the significance level is 1 in 50,000. So that really just tells you how approximate these scores are. And then like with other epidemiology, the people in the field start writing papers with lower levels of significance. Well, this might indicate this or this. And you have to study large numbers of people. So the smallest studies are millions and hundreds of millions of dollars. So we're just not there yet. We need some type of technological breakthrough to allow us to get to that next level. Yeah.
Very, very interesting. I come from Colombia, right. South America, and we have a huge problem with congenital heart disease. And it's mostly due to lack of education and even say nutrition in the mothers. So I thought it was fascinating what you said about folic acid, and you certainly made it sound very simple. But how could you approach something that's a national health problem in a developing country where you're aiming at trying to reduce an incidence of congenital heart disease that's in actual fact 10 times higher than what you have here in the States?
See, we talked a little bit yesterday. What I would do is just form little clubs of pregnant mothers where they would come in and together eat a made-up shake that would have in it the folate, the protein, and stuff they need, so at least to get one really good meal every day, and along with that, all the vitamins they need for the whole day. It turns out if you go with vitamin tablets to a country and you say, take these, people start wearing them around their necks and things like that. You just have no idea. It's just not a habit that people would take a tablet. So getting people to actually take a tablet, take it every day. 50% of Americans take vitamins. Only 35% take them regularly. So remembering to take the vitamin is a really important part of this, even for women who are pregnant. So I think that you have a cultural challenge in Colombia, and I do go all over the world, as I told you, and happy to work with you on that, but I think social interaction and other people making it socially acceptable, that's the way to get to this, and I think you'll have good results. Yes?
You mentioned the example of Tommy Lasorda, you know, losing 50 pounds, right, and gaining it back, and I've seen that from friends and
sure,
family, what it is, and they come back to about that same point. Is there a predisposed set point? And also, is there something else,
you know, absolutely. We have just published a study on people who've lost weight and regained it up to 7 times in our center. And the interesting thing is they usually come back to our weight loss program before they reach their maximum weight, and they're able to lose weight at exactly the same rate they did the time before. So, you know, Mark Twain tried to stop smoking 10 times. And people, I like to say psychology trumps physiology. Okay, so we can all lose weight, but it's the intention to do it and then sticking with it and making it a pleasant part of your lifestyle. And I think exercise, while it's not a great way to lose weight, is a great way to keep it off. So getting into a daily routine of exercise after you've made your changes and keeping a meal replacement there once a day, I found has been very, very effective. A meal replacement, a shake once a day. And we know much more about the shakes today. I mean, I'm not hungry all morning because I have 25 grams of protein with my breakfast shake, and it just goes on. And that's my routine, not here at this meeting, but it's my routine at home. So I think getting people into that routine is a very, very positive kind of a thing to do. Yes, you've been waiting a long time.
Well, we read a lot about the Italian diet and how it's
not training.
I'm not going to ask about the red wine, but I am interested in olive oil. You know, you talked about the oils that we, you know, the corn oil you should be eating.
Yes, olive oil is a very healthy fat. It's similar to the avocado in having what are called omega-9 fats in it, which is a monounsaturated fat. It is 140 calories a tablespoon, however, and this is where I fall out with the Mediterranean diet folks. There were many Mediterranean diets. Turns out tomatoes didn't enter the Mediterranean diet until after the year 1500 because they're a New World fruit that came back to Italy. Hungarian paprika came from the New World. So the European diet of ancient times, if you look at wheat and lentils and all those things, didn't include many of the things that you would think of in the modern diet. Furthermore, in Italy itself, southern Italy, where they eat less of red meat, has less breast cancer than northern Italy and less prostate cancer than people in northern Italy eat more red meat. And so it just depends on how much vegetables and other things are in the diet, the type of pasta they eat. They eat whole wheat durum pasta. They don't eat the same pasta we get at the spaghetti factory. So there are a number of things, as people put monikers on these, that you have to be careful with. But I think that olive oil is a very healthy fat to use for cooking. Extra virgin olive oil in particular has antioxidants in it, and it's very, very good. Yes, although, again, if you're trying to lose weight, 140 calories in a tablespoon may be the difference of a woman losing a pound a week or staying the same. I just use lemon or balsamic vinegar without the oil.
Flaxseed
oil is interesting. I actually don't recommend flaxseed oil. It has a lot of omega-6 as well as omega-3 in it. And what you're trying to do is change the proportion of omega-3 and omega-6 in your fat tissue. So you eat a low-fat diet, which lowers your omega-6. We put women on a low-fat diet. We can measure in their blood a 30% drop in omega-6 fatty acids. Now you add in your 3 grams of fish oil, and you have a big impact. It's just like putting a little bit of colored dye into a big glass of water or a small glass of water. Put it into the small glass of water, it'll get darker. So put more fish oil into less fat in your body, you do better. Whether you dilute that fat with olive oil or another oil. So olive oil helps with taste, but I would go easy on the olive oil. Yes?
Back to the Mediterranean or European diet, what about the red wine?
Red wine is a rich source of resveratrol and other polyphenols. And one glass a day of red wine, actually the California wine industry succeeded in getting a health claim for red wine. And, one glass of red wine is fine. It all depends on how you interpret it. There's some people that, have the whole bottle. So, I mean, it just depends on where you go with that, Grape juice has for those people who don't want the alcohol part, grape juice has many of the same polyphenols. Pomegranate juice has polyphenols. These are very, very healthy substances. That's a tough question I can't really answer. I mean, I think you have to be very careful when you go to a strict vegan diet. The amount of protein that you get in, I think you have to use soy protein to increase the proteins. I think people can survive all types of diets. Obviously, the Japanese are doing very well on soy, ocean fish, and vegetables. Children will pick finger foods and a wide variety of foods that they like to eat by taste. So I think that, children's nutrition is a very, politically tough topic. I think each parent needs to decide on how to raise their children. But you've got to be sure that you've got energy balance, they're getting enough calories for growth, that they're getting the adequate fatty acids for brain growth, like the fish oil fats, the DHA. If you want a strict vegan diet, fruits and vegetables are very low in fat, so you might want to have fish in the diet. You might have fish oils in the diet. Nutrition has got a number of parameters we know about today. We'll probably know more tomorrow, but a variety of food groups is a good idea. Not eliminating foods is a really important thing. Yes?
If you're not in favor of flax oil, what does a vegan do for the omega-3 fatty acids?
I mean, if you're morally opposed to fish oil.
Yeah.
You can get algae DHA. So algae, you can get algae fish. Remember I told you the fish get the fish oil by eating algae? You can actually get marine oils, which are odorless. They're fairly expensive. A company named Martech makes them, and it's extracted from algae. The body will convert 18 carbon fatty acids like you find in flaxseed oil to the 20 and 22 carbon, but you do so less efficiently as you age. So by taking in the 22 carbon DHA, which is like the EPA, some of that DHA will be converted back to EPA, and you don't actually have to get the fish oils. You get marine algae oils. Okay? Yes, over here.
Could you elaborate a little bit on the vitamins and the supplemental vitamins that you were talking about, like the vitamin D? What others would you suggest? A and B, what about a multivitamin?
I think a multivitamin is the basic. And I write about this in my book. Multivitamin is the basic. You start out with a multivitamin. It's not going to hurt you, okay? Multivitamin is the basic. You probably are getting some vitamins in there you don't need that are already in the food supply if you're eating a healthy diet. But most of the water-soluble ones will come out in your urine that day. And someday, for personalized nutrition, we'll be taking urine samples on people. And those urine samples will tell us, have they been taking in adequate pomegranate juice, have they been taking in their multivitamin and so forth. We'll look at a whole spectrum on a mass spectrometer. This actually would be economically feasible today. We are right now developing a robotic assay in our laboratory for the balance of omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids, where we can take a fingertip blood sample and do 300 to 400 samples in a morning and look at how when we change the diet, we change the omega-3, omega-fat balance in the tissues. We're developing that technology right now. So there's going to be technology for this personalization. So beyond that, I think calcium and vitamin D are important for women, for bone. Vitamin E, which has been much maligned with a terrible study in which 1 out of 20 studies showed damage, and they did what's called a meta-analysis where they clumped different studies together. My friend David Krichevsky, who's in his middle 70s, says meta-analysis is to analysis as metaphysics is to physics. So, you know, it's like not valid. It's not real science. But there was obviously somebody wanted to kill off vitamin E, okay? And they succeeded in doing it. So with, you know, a 30% drop in vitamin E sales. I still take vitamin E, 200 international units a day. Yes?
Scoring part of the American food industry is the organic food movement.
Right.
Your general thoughts about organic?
I think it's very important to regulate pesticides to some extent. Bruce Ames very unpopularly said that, you know, more protective substances in fruits and vegetables that will counteract the pesticides. Having said that, we know that there are species that are extinct and we need to reduce the pesticides. Having said that, I don't think the organic legislation is perfect. You can still have pesticides in the soil as long as you don't spray them on the plants. But I think organic is an important step. It's a way of people endorsing what I think is a healthy food movement. So we have grocery stores that are a very small fraction of all of them, but they're growing the most rapidly. And I think we as citizens should support that movement, even if it's not scientifically perfect. Yes, Linda? Yes. Oh, nuts are very healthy for you. Depends which. See, I used to rail against the peanut because it was eaten like a snack food, and it's all about the context. Almonds have a wonderful coating with antioxidant flavonoids in the coating of the almond. 8 almonds after you work out or whatever. It's a good source of monounsaturated fats, great source of minerals, vitamins, B vitamins, and energy. We've been working on a pistachio recently, and we discovered on the inside of a pistachio, I don't know if you have any with you, they have a little bit of purple and a little bit of green. It's the only nut with purple color in it. And I got real excited. I called Stuart that day. Oh, so he said, boy, it doesn't take much to get you excited. There's a purple and a pistachio. But anyway, there are actually anthocyanins in there. So there are lots of health benefits. Brazil nuts, for instance, have selenium. The thing about if you buy mixed nuts in America, they're 49% peanuts because peanuts are $2 a pound. And all the other nuts are about $6 a pound. So there's an economic influence. So, and I think peanuts need to be used as a flavoring. They're used in Asian cooking for the flavor. You melt peanut butter and use a little bit of it, not slather it onto a sandwich for some poor child to be eating. So I think that you know, nuts have their proper place. It's all a matter of context. But I think healthy snacking on nuts, pistachios, almonds, other nuts is very, very healthy for you.
Well, what's wrong with peanuts? I mean, here's low blood sugar, and I remember Adele Davis, that was...
Yeah, because they're high in fat, they have a low glycemic index, so they won't tend to raise your blood sugar as much. But the oil in there is a monounsaturated oil, largely. You know, they're produced in Georgia. There's obviously a big lobby to promote peanuts, but to me, it's not... It's actually a bean, not a nut. It actually should not be classified in the nut group. It's actually a bean.
Quick question about plum juice. How many ounces do you recommend a day,
like what?
Like seltzer
water? Oh, yeah, absolutely. And most people should take in about 8 ounces a day. Most of our research would be 8 ounces a day of pomegranate juice.
Is it absorbed differently?
With seltzer? No. No, not at all. No, it's... Go ahead.
We have done our research on POM,
yeah.
Obviously. We're the largest growers in the world.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're victims of our own success. So if you go to the supermarket and you can't find it, I'm sorry. But we have put all of our stores on allocation, we're only getting 30% of the orders. And now there's a new study that just came out about prostate cancer. Yes. And you just wipe out the shelves of the frame. But at heart, in January, we're marketing Comex, which is really as powerful or more powerful than pomegranate juice. And we'll have it in pill form and also in extract.
It will grow pomegranates where we used to grow corn.
Yeah, but it only took 6-7 years
for pomegranates. Do it climatically wise.
No, I think that, you know, what we've done is it's very similar to the environmental stuff we heard about yesterday. We have completely changed our ecology with good intentions of feeding everybody, and we've overdone it. We now have an undernourished but over-caloried society of obese, overweight people. 80% of all heart disease in the next 10 years will be type 2 diabetes. $130 billion a year the U.S. government spends on obesity-related diseases, about 30 different ones. So these things we're talking about with supplements and so forth, these are the answer, and I think we really have to have a major societal change in how we deal with our internal environment. Do I need to stop? All right. One last burning question.
Well, all these tidbits of information you mentioned, a book or a couple of different books, where can we get one source that would, you know, help us when we go home and reiterate the educators?
Well, you know, there's a lot of information on the internet. I use that myself all the time. You can find any study done anywhere on PubMed. I think my books are here in the bookstore. I'm not sure. The What Color Is Your Diet? Are both of them there? Or just they're both there. So both LA Shape Diet, which is a later one, and What Color Is Your Diet are there. They're both there. You can read those. That was great. That was fun. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have a